Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and today we start the show by talking about adding winter interest to your garden. And our guest, Mark Dwyer, back with us. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He's a speaker, educator, author, degrees in landscape architecture and urban forestry, and it's always great to talk with Mark. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in with your gardening questions or comments. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mark Dwyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Let's start by talking about the winter garden. The gardens can be pretty boring at this time of the year. What's the first step in adding some interest?
Well, it's always a great question, Larry, because the reality on the ground in winter is it's certainly tough to compete visually with what we see in spring, summer, and fall. But I feel like we should be looking out on a landscape in our residential areas and elsewhere that offers a lot of extended interest and still has a lot of beauty to it. So this is the best time of year to examine a landscape and start thinking, boy, you know, I think I could include more ornamental grasses here, something with colorful stems, or, you know, the features of plants that become more prominent in winter when we're starved for that color. We can incorporate those into our landscape, but now's a great time to make those evaluations.
Yeah. Is there a good place to go for inspiration?
I feel like any public garden that's still open. And
yeah,
of course, when you're, you know, walking the dogs around your, you know, your neighborhoods, take a look, because some things are going to pop out, whether it's a beautiful conifer with a nice blue tone or something that's very textural. And granted, the eye tends to pass over a lot of our browns and beiges in these winter months, but there's certainly beauty to be found. So I love going to Olbrich Botanical Garden. It's fairly close to me in Madison, and they're open over the winter months to, whether you're enjoying the heat of the conservatory or hoofing it out through the gardens, there's a lot of things to be seen, of course.
Yeah, I kind of like to walk around outside and then go into the conservatory to kind of warm up. Favorite plants for adding color to your winter landscape? It kind of sounds like you do.
Well, I'm real big on conifers to start with because they become anchor points for the entire season. So the placement of a beautiful conifer should be doing something throughout the growing season. So it's a backdrop in spring, summer, and fall. But in winter, say something like a concolor fir with that beautiful powder blue tone is gorgeous. Or evergreens that get a nice yellow tint to them. I'm also a huge fan of colorful stems, whether they're from dogwoods, getting into the reds, oranges, and yellows. And there's a lot of great willows that are become cutback shrubs where their new vigorous growth throughout the growing season gets in a very intense coloration into the winter months. And my personal favorite is a willow called Flame. And its stems right now are the brightest orange-red you could imagine. You can see it from 100 yards away.
That would add a lot of interest. I don't have one of those. Maybe I should. Well, along with the plants, are there other design elements that you can bring to the winter yard to make it look more inviting?
Well, I think about my backyard as an example. Well, one of the things we like to do is add paint colors to different structures, vining structures, arbors, and that certainly combines with our growing season interest. But in winter, the fact that our garden furniture on the back deck is painted blue, that's a wonderful blue contribution. So it's non-living color. So when we think about our structures out in the garden, they can offer interest. But again, there's such a wide range of plant material, and there's nothing like a light snowfall, getting that pure white to kind of set things off. But don't ever hesitate to use non-living elements, as I call them, to offer additional interest as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. What about grasses for the winter? I grasses can add some winter interest if you leave them alone until spring. Is that okay to do, by the way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think it's important to mention, as I did with conifers, that, you know, with the use of with grasses, your placement and utilization should take into account spring, summer, and fall. But in winter, there's some wonderful grasses that have the stature to withstand snow and you know, the winter months, where they're offering interesting seed heads, movement, texture. I should mention not all grasses are created equal, so there's many of our perennial grasses lack that winter stature where they're flattened with the first snow. So know your grass for not only that, but what it needs from you in terms of soil and sunlight. But there's a great range of native grasses like big blue stem switchgrass, Indian grass, and then getting into some of the non-natives that have very strong winter presence and look great all the way till March when we start to cut them back and wait for that new growth to emerge.
What are some of those?
Well, some of the besides the native grasses I mentioned, there's quite a few miscanthus or maiden grasses that are quite nice, although there are some that are spreaders, so it goes back to knowing your grass. Some of the penicetums or fountain grasses, the majority of those are non-native. They offer some interesting kind of tufty flower heads into winter. There's very few grasses that will withstand, you know, a foot of wet snow. You know, just about everything gets flattened. But I love seeing grasses. I'm thinking about the healing garden here at Edgerton Hospital, where we're looking out on feather reed grass. That very, very narrow grass is looking quite nice and vertical. And the miscanthus I mentioned with the beautiful plumes, that's kind of our pampas grass equivalent in the Midwest. But again, knowing what grasses need from you, but there are some that are prone to reseeding. So it's important to know what you're getting into with certainly any plant you install.
And when you, I'm wondering, when you are purchasing those, I mean, you need to be a little careful because they're not always listed as being kind of invasive.
Right. Well, that's the real challenge, because you'll see a grass, the plant tag will say something like vigorous, exclamation point. And as a consumer, you're like, well, that sounds great. Of course, I want a vigorous plant. Well, that's one way of saying, you know, be careful. And a great example, and it's an amazing plant, but the switchgrass, the panicum called Northwind, which is Roy Diblick's selection out of Northwind Perennial Farm near Lake Geneva, wonderful, very upright form of the native switchgrass, absolutely gorgeous in the landscape, you know, 6 to 7 feet right now, just a nice amber color. In open soils, areas where you don't have mulch, this thing can reseed. It can be quite prolific. And switchgrass does that. That's how it spreads, by seed. And so in a landscape, I hear nightmare stories about trying to dig out switchgrass, but I have Northwind at home and here at the Healing Garden. And what we do is we put it in an area where there's quite a bit of mulch and we're not worried about the seed germinating. So there's a case of knowing your plant.
Are any of those, do you need to divide those at all or ever over time?
Yeah, great question, Larry, because the short answer is yes. As with many perennials, as they expand, most of the vigorous growth year after year is on the outer perimeter of that crown. So what a ornamental grass will do over the years is vacate the original center, the oldest portion of the plant, and the expansion is out in this, I call it a donut. So like literally as this plant emerges in spring with new growth, if you have a hollow center and just a ring of growth, it's time to divide, which is quite a bit of elbow grease with the larger grasses, but you can dig them up, slice and dice, and relocate. You can even recolonize that center if desired. But the danger in a donut for any type of perennial, and this happens with many perennials, they can be prone to being floppy and you're kind of missing something in the center. So look for donuts in your spring garden, folks, but grasses will need that division.
And your favorite grasses, again, are...
Well, I love those panicums, that Northwind switchgrass I love, but there's a lot of great big blue stem is common in our prairies. There's a wonderful big blue stem called Blackhawks, which in summer turns deep, deep maroon. It has an amazing late season fall color. So Blackhawks, big blue stem, Northwind, panicum, and the Indian grass or sorghastrum, there's a variety called Sioux Blue, and that's Sioux as in Native American tribe, S-I-O-U-X, blue. And it's this steely powder blue in the landscape on a 6 to 7 foot tall grass. So I tend to lean into the natives, but go to your local garden centers and certainly envision where these can be placed for winter interest, but also contributors throughout the season.
Mark Dwyer with us today. His business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. We're taking a look at color for all the seasons and certainly answering your gardening questions as we move along, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. Give a call, shoot us an email. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR. On this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Mark Dwyer, his business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. And again, questions for him, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Don emailed to ask, what kinds of grass or ground cover do you recommend for a low-mow lawn?
Well, low-mow lawns are becoming really big. The idea that you have shorter stature grasses, perhaps some forbs, some bloomy material that combines to create this sort of matrix or mat that either needs very little mowing or maybe even once a year. And I would encourage folks to visit Olbrich to see their meadow gardens and see what they've utilized for shorter grasses. There's a wide range. It kind of depends on what height works for you, but there's a wide range of sedges and even native grasses that stay in that lower portion. And I've seen a huge focus on using something called autumn moor grass, or Cecillaria, is a great lower stature grass. And it's a nice clumper, so you can use these in tandem. But a great example of larger spaces that, again, include a mixture of different plants to create a low-mow situation can be found at Olbrich, and they really do it well.
Yeah, they do indeed. Mary Ann in Green Bay is wondering, what cold-tolerant annuals can you recommend for her planters? She's done pansies to death.
Yeah, no, I have some ideas, and certainly bop over to the Green Bay Botanic Garden, which is exceptional as well, and I'm sure you'll see some great examples. But when you think of containers, it's great this was brought up, because a lot of folks consider containers as a post-Mother's Day, what am I doing for summer? But think about bookending your containers with cool season plantings in the spring or in the fall. So you're starting earlier, of course, and aside from pansies, which are really short-lived perennials, and the wide range of violets you can purchase, consider focusing on cold-tolerant greens. There's a lot of neat mustards, like purple-leaf mustards, a lot of the cabbages, kales, chards. So there's a lot of greens you can put into early containers that are also edible. But in terms of flowering annuals, independent of pansies, I rely on Nemesia, and that's N-E-M-E-S-I-A, Nemesia, very cold-tolerant. There's Linaria, L-I-N-A-R-I-A. Linaria is used extensively at Olbrich in their very early containers. And these are plants, again, that won't mind 50 to 60 degree days and 37 degree nights. They won't like a hard frost, but when you go to your local garden centers, ask for those cold-tolerant annuals, because they're frequently available in March, because you're putting them in April, to bookend the season. So again, look for Nemesia, Linaria, and some cool season greens to augment your containers.
Yeah, this is good advice. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the kind of roller coaster weather that we've had here in Wisconsin and across the country for that matter. What can we do to protect our gardens in weather that's like a roller coaster? Anything?
It's really difficult. You know, I think about the fact that we have almost no snow on the ground in the Janesville area, and we're heading into another really cold spell. So there's not a lot of that winter blanket of snow is something I always like to have, to be honest. But I'm at the point where I'm putting up some burlap, some stakes and burlap around some of my evergreens, because I'm concerned about winter burn. Just very cold, desiccating winds. And again, we had kind of a dry late summer into fall, too. So I feel like we're still down on precipitation from the end of last year. So in larger scale landscapes, Larry, there's not a lot you can do. And Mother Nature always seems to sort it out, and I'm always pleased that I don't see more damage than I expect. But we still have a lot of winter left.
I guess so. There's a lot of time left for this winter yet. Well, what should you do if one of your plants or shrubs seems dead in the spring?
Well, adequate water becomes important, and don't be too quick with a shovel for removal. If I see a shrub that looks dead, I tend to scratch and bend the stems. If I see any green or pliability, that's a good sign. If it's dry and snaps, that's not so good. But I still wouldn't remove anything until you start heading into later May and June, because you may have some just late foliation and a stress plant that still might recover. So, you know, you thin the herd a little bit later in season once you see what's happening. But if the plants are hardy, hopefully they'll make it through. It's just tough to say with, again, some these temperature fluctuations, as you've mentioned, Larry, are disconcerting.
Yeah, they are indeed. Mark Dwyer, our guest. Questions for him? I hope he'll join in. Kind of quiet today. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned the Healing Garden, and your manager of the Healing Garden at Edgerton Hospital, which we've talked about a number of times, and I haven't been down there to see it yet. I want to go. What do you do with the garden in the winter? Is it still used in some fashion?
Not necessarily. I guess I should say both yes and no. So not actively, because concerns with snow and ice, we try to keep it relatively clear, but I feel it's being used because the hospital was positioned to have primary views from the rehabilitative wing and the therapy wing right into the garden. So people are still looking out on a beautiful winter landscape, which we've been talking about, but we don't see a lot of active use until March rolls around.
Megan in Eau Claire is interested in adding rhododendrons to her landscape. Will they grow in her area, and what do they require?
Yeah, rhododendrons and azaleas, which are very closely related, they would be hardy in Eau Claire, but you have a smaller palette than you would certainly further south or in the southeast United States. So I would talk to the garden centers in your area, because there is a list of rhododendrons that are quite hardy. The challenge isn't so much the cold of winter. They're just very particular with soils. So it's an issue of they thrive in acidic soils. So when I was at Rotary Gardens, our rhododendrons and azaleas all had a lot of TLC with soil preparation, sharp drainage, acidified soils. And you give them actually more sun than most people relegate them to shady locations, and they are quite shade tolerant. But getting some degree of sunlight is really vital for them filling out and having their best blooms. So get a little more consultation locally, but you absolutely can grow those plants if you can commit to that TLC I mentioned.
Let's take some calls. Don in Wisconsin Rapids, what's on your mind?
Just looking for native plants to create a little bit of a nice look, but also a barrier for sound between our residents and our road that we're adjacent to. Not a lot of sound year-round, a lot of traffic, agricultural traffic being in the country, a lot of equipment moving and things of that nature, and just looking for a natural sound barrier instead of putting up a man-made one, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, great question, because when you think about how sound travels, particularly in winter, the idea of incorporating native plants makes sense, and you would start leaning into, of course, height is a big thing for deflecting sound. So you start leaning into some of these taller native grasses we've talked about. And I would encourage you to chat with Prairie Nursery over in Westfield and see what they might recommend, because the challenge isn't so much finding taller plants. It's just making sure you have a combination that works together, where you don't have plants that become overbearing or take over. But if you have any opportunity to incorporate native conifers, like the native juniper, Juniperus virginiana, which is eastern red cedar, having some evergreens will provide some of that deflection as well. So you could pepper in some woody plants. And there's a wide range of native woody plants that, hand in hand with herbaceous material, these grasses included, would be a nice composition to consider. But again, Prairie Nursery may get you started with some of the perennials. For sure.
Don, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Elizabeth in Platteville, your turn. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Because I was familiar with red and yellow twig dogwood, it's a nice contrast in winter when there's snow on the ground, because the twigs, the color of the twigs really stands out with the snow.
Good points. Comment on that, Mark.
You know, winter's the time to appreciate those, because their best intensity of stem coloration, and this is red twig and yellow twig, is when the leaves drop and fall and then the sun hits them. They really get intense. But I will say, if you're into that, the winter coloration of both red and yellow stem dogwoods, consider their summer look, because there are some variegated selections where the foliage has a nice crisp variegation. And so you get the benefit of the ornamentality of those leaves. And so when I, all my colorful stem dogwoods I utilize, I lean into variegation. Like red stem dogwoods, there's one called Ivory Halo, great white variegation. Yellow stem dogwoods, there's a beautiful one called Silver and Gold, which has variegation and also that bright yellow stem color. So, but excellent comment by the caller. The intensity, even on, particularly on a day like today, is amazing, but the snow sets it off for sure.
Yeah, good points. Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Joe in Arlington. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Quick question regarding the ornamental grasses. How susceptible are they to deer turning them into nothing but dust?
That's a common question for just about every plant here in Wisconsin, for sure. It really depends on the grass, but most are resistant, particularly those native grasses. So when I mentioned big blue stem, there's also little blue stem, prairie drop seed, switchgrass, Indian grass, very resistant to browsing. And if there, any browsing occurs, the regeneration is quite quick. So I don't, ornamental grasses as a category, I don't see a lot of deer browse, to be honest, in my situation in southern Wisconsin. So I feel comfortable saying I don't feel you'll regret planting them because of that potential problem.
Yeah. Joe, there you go. Thank you. Let's turn to Jeanette in Darlington. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. Good morning. My husband is a beekeeper, and I do biology, and he and I also work on doing some small little plots here and there for replenishing some native prairie, as well as some woodlands. And something we've noticed with the beekeeping, with our honeybees and a lot of the native bumblebees and things, they are very sensitive to not only the insecticides, but also fungicides. So something I'd started several years ago, if I was looking to buy plants at big box stores or even some of the nurseries in hardware stores, I would ask them if their plants are treated with neonicotinoids, because even if it's something that you've bought, it stays systemically in those plants and can be harmful to our beneficial insects.
Jeanette, thank you very much for calling. Mark, I'm sure you have a comment on that as well.
That's amazingly great advice that everyone should heed, because the neonicotinoids, and feel, do a Google search on this, folks. So neonics, as they're called, as a caller mentioned, they're integrated into the plant. And the intention in their use is to grow these plants for purchase without problems. But the issue is that neonics affect the nervous system of our pollinators. So bees that are coming to these petunias later on are affected adversely by those chemicals. So I'm not sure about current EPA branding or labeling, but I've seen labels that have indicated whether neonicotinoids have been used or not used. So ask those pointed questions. And it can be as simple as saying, what's the history of these plants? What have they been treated with? Because you don't want to carry that chemical input into your home landscape and adversely affect our native pollinators. Nobody does. So be a little more informed on your purchases, folks. And I think that's a great comment to, again, to heed when you're out in spring buying.
Absolutely. Let's turn to Janine in Fond du Lac. She emailed. She has numerous mandevilla vines that she's wintering over in the house. In the spring, she'll plant them outside to grow on an arbor. And her question is, should she plant them directly in the ground or should she leave them in pots and plant the pots into the ground?
Well, that's a, you know, mandevilla is absolutely beautiful, and it's nice to hear. And for anyone who ever purchases mandevilla and the closely related diplodenia, they're pretty much the same thing. But these gorgeous tropical vines, you want to perpetuate them year after year. Don't put them for one season and then put them in the compost pile. Bring them inside, as this caller has done. But with mandevilla, you can plant them directly in the ground, but if you keep them in their existing container, whether you insert that in ground or leave it above grade, you can be a little more in control of that warming up quicker, and also fertilizer applications become important because mandevillas are heavy feeders. Not so much with nitrogen, which would be a lot of stem and foliar growth, but a nice balanced fertilizer in that container or in the ground would encourage more blooms. If you're doing your mandevilla in the ground, I would directly plant it in the ground, I would amend that soil heavily with compost, make it nice and rich. But either option in a nutshell is really fine.
Let's go to Paula in Green Bay next. Hi, Paula.
Oh, good morning, guys. I have a question regarding when to cut back native grasses. I've got quite a few in my different gardens, and I keep them up through the winter for native insects and this, but then I keep hearing, all right, don't cut them back too soon in the spring, and then I feel like I wait too long, and there's green stuff. And so when is the optimum time to cut them back?
Question. And with grasses, there's both cool and warm season grasses, and that really relates to when they start emerging from the soil and ultimately growing. That's neither here nor there, because once you start seeing any growth, that's the latest time you really want to start cutting. So that'll vary depending on Mother Nature and where you are latitude-wise in the state. So what I like to do is I'm typically cutting grasses in later March, early April, as it's warming up. And don't let a warm day in February fool you where you're like, I'm just going to go get those grasses, because they're still offering interest, and there's a likelihood that some of our native pollinators or insects might be sheltering within that debris. So cut grasses back as late as you possibly can. And a great example, Olbrich, I've mentioned a couple times in Madison, they don't start cleaning up many of their grasses or garden beds until April, because they want those pollinators to hatch out, do their thing before it gets too warm. But once you start seeing any sort of active growth, definitely get in there and chop away.
Paulo, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Jim, who's on the Wisconsin-Illinois border. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Many years ago, I went with the DNR here in Illinois. On, I had an 8-acre hay field that I used for animals, and we got rid of, didn't have any animals anymore. And I put it in a tall grass prairie, and I've got big blue stem and little blue stem and switchgrass and Indian grass. And I try to burn it every year, every spring. And this last year, I didn't get a chance to because of the winds and stuff. I was surprised how it come back this year without burning it. But my neighbor to the east of me, is in, she's got a probably a 5-acre field there across the fence from me. And she's soon to have a Indian grass prairie of her own.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great comment. First of all, I applaud you on having that much acreage with these native grasses. And don't worry if you miss a burn. At Rotary Gardens, we had a small prairie restoration, and we would burn it every 2 or 3 years, and that seemed adequate, you know, with it, that ash dropping. The reason, other reason for the burn is to get out some of the invasives like multiflora rose and things that shouldn't be there, hopefully get burned out. But to the comment about the Indian grass moving over to your neighbors, that's one of the challenges. Switchgrass and Indian grass in particular, and big blue stem to a certain degree, can be prolific reseeders. And so in terms of reproducing, they're producing a ton of seed. And as it's dropping or floating on the breeze, when it finds open soil, it germinates. So in a prairie situation, everything sort of balances out. They're fighting for root space and real estate. So that's why you don't get, you know, prairies that have been done well. aren't dominated entirely by grasses, but they certainly can gain a foothold. So that's something for people to keep in mind in their residential scale, as well as going back to knowing the grass.
Yeah, good point. Jim, I bet you that provides a lot of pleasure for you over the course of the year.
And, the wildlife, especially, you know, when that stuff is 6 and 7 foot high and we get these cold winds like this, them deer and stuff, they really hunker down in that.
Oh, sure. I bet it does. I would love to see your prairie there. It sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. I had on my show this past week, Lynn Peoples, and she had written a book called The Inner Clock, and it was about circadian rhythms. And one part that we didn't get a chance to talk about when she was on with me was the biorhythms and circadian rhythms of plants. And she was talking, she slept in a sunflower field once to watch the sunflowers. And the sunflowers, the heads of the sunflower plant would be facing east in the morning, and the heads would follow the sun, and the heads would be looking west in the evening. And she slept there because she wanted to observe them. They turn overnight to then again the flower heads face the sun, and of course they're facing the sun. And when the sun comes up, then the insects come in and grab their nectar and all of that. And I thought it was an interesting. She also talked about how certain flower species open and close their flowers each day pretty much at the same time. And one of the horticulturists she talked to said you could, if you didn't have a watch, once you knew the time of day that they opened and closed, you could pretty much go give yourself a pretty good estimate of what time it was just based on the circadian rhythm of the plants. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
It's amazing. And I've heard of folks creating these floral clocks where not an actual clock made of flowers, which can be done, but the fact that putting different plants that open at different times, and a great example would be the annual what we call 4 o'clocks or mirabilis. They truly open around 4 p.m., which is really amazing. So I don't pretend to understand all of that, but I wouldn't mind hanging out in a sunflower field and watching that happen.
She's up there. She's talking about being up at getting out of her sleeping bag at 3 in the morning, you know, just checking over the course of the night to and then sort of watching the plants actually move toward their position, yeah, so they could be positioned exactly east when the sun came up. It was fascinating story. Betty in Middleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I'm calling to see, is there any new developments in controlling or killing jumping worms?
Boy, maybe you've heard more, but all I know is that UW-Madison continues to really be on the forefront of the research. And so I'm not aware of anything new, to be honest. And I know it's still problematic for many people. And if you're a listener and you're not familiar with jumping worms, do a little research on it because it's pretty scary. But I feel like there'll be some solutions coming down the pipe in the next 10 years, hopefully.
I hope as well. Betty, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Mark, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. It was kind of short notice, and I really appreciate your expertise and your willingness to be on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Mark Dwyer with us today. His business is Landscape Prescriptions by MD. He does a lot of consulting work, but he's also the healing garden manager at Edgerton Hospital. Mark Dwyer, his business, Landscape Prescriptions by MD. Well, we got a cold spell coming up here, and it's in parts of the state it's been cold a lot more than it has in the south. And what effect has that had on the trees? We'll talk about that next with our expert, Paul Segan. I'm Larry Mueller.